3 years, Lena. How does someone apologize for 3 years in the life of a child? Lena thinks on this.
One doesn't.
One just proves he can do better. Does John have a plan for that? I pause. A lot of planning got done last night, but not all of it sounded good to me. Let me tell you about this stunt he pulled. She clicks her mouse, watches the screen, and then leans back in her chair. Go ahead. So, the first half hour or so is insanely stiff. Joe and Corey are staring at John like he's an alien invader, and I'm staring at the kids like they're my glass menagerie, and John is looking like he is ready to break into a tap dance number he's trying so hard. Corey keeps threatening to go to Trinity's house, and Joe is literally shrinking into his chair like he's hoping to blend into the wood grain. I'm about 5 minutes away from pulling the plug on the whole thing. And then John reaches into his pocket and pulls out a tiny bottle of lavender oil.
Lavender oil?
Asks Lena. Monster spray, I say. Joe and his phobia of closet monsters. Do you remember? When he was 4 or 5, John and Corey made a fake monster repellent label and glued it onto a lavender oil diffuser with Mod Podge and convinced Joe that a whiff of the stuff would kill any monsters on the spot. That exact same bottle from all those years ago. That's what he was carrying with him last night. John handed it to Corey and said they could use it on him at any time if they really, truly wanted him to go away, and he would go. He told them he loved them more than he loved life, and he wanted to be here, but if his presence hurt them, all they needed to do was say the word.
Oh, wow,
says Lena. I know, I say. And it changed everything. Corey looked at the bottle, opened it, and took a whiff, and the smell filled the air. It was the first time I had smelled that since Joe was little, and you know how scents work. Lena nods. Everything just all came back. Running through the house, spraying lavender water on the tiniest dark corners and under all the furniture, laughing and swearing we could see the monsters wither and crumble into dust. There goes one now. You just missed it. And then ending up in a pile of giggles on Joe's bed, complaining about how long it would take us to clean up all those invisible monster corpses.
You were a take-no-prisoners sort of family,
Lena says with a soft smile. I nod. And then Corey put the bottle next to Joe, and he put his hand on it, and for a second, he pointed it at John, and we all held our breath. And then he put the bottle down by the side of his plate and said, Mom, I'm starving. Is there any food? And that was it.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
I think about this. Yes, it is pretty amazing, if you disregard the slurry of confused and betrayed feelings about John that clouds my own view. But setting aside my own feelings, and isn't that kind of the heart of this job I call motherhood? My kids being able to reunite, however cautiously, with their dad after 3 years apart is indeed pretty amazing.
So that was the stunt you mentioned? Asks Lena.
I snap out of my reverie at that reminder. Oh, no. Nope, that comes next. We're passing the pesto and eating the pasta, and the mood keeps getting easier and easier. And I swear to you, John is watching my wine glass like a hawk, ready to top it off at any moment, as if I'd be fool enough to get tipsy around him. Anyway, everyone is just warming up to each other, and it's going annoyingly well. The kids are so much like him, you know, in so many ways.
Are they?
Lena asks. She and John were socially friendly, but never terribly close. I nod. Joe has the same thoughtful expressions and the same instinct to flee any danger, disappear from any tension in a puff of smoke rather than fight it out. They're both like
the wizard, not the werewolf,
Lena says. Yeah, the wizard, not the werewolf. I agree. Corey is just a straight-up half-woman, half-tiger.
A were-tiger,
Lena supplies. That's not a thing, I tell her. She just ignores me.
And how is she like John?
The sense of humor. I guess even with him in Hong Kong, they still watch all the same shows.
There were a lot of Jimmy Fallon references at the table. Like, I'm pretty sure Jimmy himself was there with us and then left and no one noticed. And they even listened to a few of the same bands. It was kind of like a first date in some ways. Oh, you like so-and-so? I love so-and-so. I saw them play live when they came over. They played Skunky McGee. Wow, they never play Skunky McGee. What is Skunky McGee now? Interrupts Lena. My attempt at thinking of a name of a hit band song, I tell her. You are bad at that, she says, and hits refresh. Yeah, I willingly admit. You know you're uncool when you can't even make up something that sounds like it might be cool. Cool is not your area. No kidding. The thing is, the more they broke the ice, the more they got all excited about the agenda for their week together. And then the conversation turned from all the awesome things they're going to do for the week to what awesome things I'm going to do while I'm kidless. And for a while, I didn't say anything. But then finally, I admitted that I might take a trip to New York, and all hell broke loose.
You might take a trip to New York?
Interjects Lena, almost a shout.
That's really, really great.
I shift my eyes sideward. I might, I say. Though by now, I have already applied to speak at the library conference. To get Country Day to pay for the registration, I have to do at least one presentation. So, on a wild hair, I decided to float the latest reading engagement idea I've been trying this spring. It was surprisingly fun to flesh out a conference proposal, put fingers to keyboard, and hit send. There's a library conference at Columbia, I tell her. I thought it might be worthwhile. Plus, I'll get my continuing ed hours done early. Lena frowns and loses interest.
I was hoping you were going to New York to party and have sex with strange men.
Oh, yeah, that sounds just like me, I say sarcastically. Maybe I'll get a tattoo while I'm there.
The infinity symbol on your lower back? She asks.
120.125, I banter back. Lena looks at me questioningly. The Dewey Decimal Classification for infinity? I supply. Not that we use that anymore. It turns out 120.125 was not actually infinite.
That's deep, says Lena.
Oh, I got it! Got what? I ask, still thinking about the larger 120 category in Dewey. It's epistemology, knowledge about knowledge, one of my favorites.
The bag! Look!
She tilts the screen again. Next to the window of the consignment site, there's the Longchamp site. Same bag, a full $1,000 more.
Holy crap! What in God's name are you going to do with an $1,100 bag?
I ask.
Sell it on eBay, she tells me simply. $400 or $500 more than I paid for it.
You've got to be kidding me. People will pay that much for a used purse? Lena shrugs.
I have the last few times I've done this. Maybe they turn around and sell it for $900. Who knows?
I take everything back, I tell her. That was 10 minutes well spent. She nods with a smile.
See?
What exactly are you going to do with that extra $500 in your pocket? I ask her. I've never known Lena to have a ton of extra money, which I previously put down to a teacher's salary and a handbag habit.
I'm buying a mic stand and a new cordless microphone.
I looked at her, confused.
For the day's camp, talent show night.
Domestic abuse youth services, Lena's volunteer passion.
Ah, Lena, I say.
I love you.
I'm buying myself this, too,
she says, clicking over to a cute canvas slouch bag with some gentle wear on consignment for $35.
Now that looks more like you, I say. You can borrow it anytime you want, she says. Maybe take it to New York.
If I go to New York.
Please go to New York, says Lena. Please consider having just a little bit of fun while you're there.
That's what John said, after a fashion, right in front of the kids. Like it's not his fault my life isn't cartwheels and champagne fountains.
He said you should have a little bit of fun? What's so bad about that?
He tried to give me his credit card, I say, spitting out the words. Lena pushes away from her desk and looks up at me in surprise.
What now?
He wants to treat me while he's with the kids.
That's what he said. It made me want to barf.
A man wants to care lovingly for your kids and give you a blank check to spend while he does so? And that makes you want to barf? Lena asks.
I roll my eyes at her. I can take care of myself. I don't want to be bought off.
I suppose you could look at this that way.
I'm not taking his money, Lena. It's dirty money. When John ran for it, he left me really hard up. We were used to his level of income. I was staying home with the kids, and I hadn't put my MLS degree to use at all in, what, 12 years? If this job hadn't come up when it did, if faculty didn't get reduced tuition, my kids' lives would have been turned upside down. It was an awful time. I mean, to leave a librarian stranded on her own with two kids? It's not cool.
No, it's not. You did an amazing job hitting the ground running. Letting John give you a week's spending money wouldn't undo that.
I tighten my jaw and shake my head. It feels like it would.
So you told him no? I did. I told him thanks, but no thanks.
Then the kids started in on me, saying I should take the credit card.
I bet they did.
They're on your side, just like I am. I refuse to hear this. They just like spending other people's money. Corey was talking about New York restaurants she's seen on Bravo shows. Joe was going on about the glories of the National History Museum and the Transit Museum and the Tenement Museum. Ugh, that boy. God save me if he wastes all his greatness on a history degree.
Lena laughs. You don't want Joe to get a history degree now?
I want him to get a degree in Joe being happy for the rest of his life, I tell her. Short of that, I guess, pre-law.
I actually think those two majors are diametrically opposed. But then, what do I know? I teach ethics.
I laugh at her and shake my head. I know it's not my future to choose, but it is so, so hard not to see what you think would make your kids happy and just sort of herd them in that direction. Joe is so good in his heart. I'm afraid he'll do a job that is not well valued in our society, like social work or public school teaching, and his little spirit will get broken.
I hear you. I can only imagine how it feels to let your kids make their own mistakes,
says Lena, gently reminding me that in both my mothering and teaching jobs, that skill is probably the single most important tool we have. But it's hard, looking ahead, seeing their mistakes coming. And then, unless they are in actual mortal danger, holding their hands as they make them anyway.
Point taken.
I think the thing about Joe that makes it so tricky is that he always makes such good decisions. I don't have any practice letting him screw up on his own.
Lena smiles at me. Then he'll make a good decision on careers when the time comes.
A good decision for himself,
in the moment he's in.
I nod. And then spot myself an excellent segue.
And not taking John's credit card is the right decision for me in the moment I'm in.
But the kids acted like I was being the biggest party pooper, and John insisted. I mean, he went on and on and on until I finally agreed I'd take his card for emergencies and incidentals as they came up.
So now I'm the proud owner of my ex-husband's American Express number. And here's the worst thing. Are you ready for it?
Lena nods.
Lay it on me.
I say to him, right there at dinner, trying to defend my position, I say, well, there's no point in my even taking it because my using a card with a man's name on it is going to raise some serious eyebrows, isn't it? And do you know what he says? He says, I already had the company issue me one with your name. Should be here in 2 days. And I say, what? They'll give you a credit card with your ex-wife's name on it? And he says, right in front of the kids, well, you're not really my ex-wife, are you? Lena starts and spins in her chair.
What now?
That's what they said, too.
You're still married to John?
I thought you filed years ago.
I definitely filed. Isn't there such thing as a common law divorce? There is not such a thing as a common law divorce, says Lena with conviction. As you well know, don't play dumb with me. I shrug. He was in Hong Kong. Lawyers are expensive. Working through a divorce seemed too painful at first, and then just entirely unnecessary as time went on. Unnecessary how? Wouldn't you have gotten court-ordered child support? I sigh. He should have paid without a judge telling him to, I say. I shouldn't have had to demand it. He should have been there taking care of his children without a court order. Lena's eyebrows hit the ceiling. So you martyred yourself rather than stand up to John. I stood on my own 2 feet, I correct, and it probably came out for the better anyway. Most of our assets are in the house, and he signed the deed over to me without a word. And I'm hesitant to tell Lena the next part, hesitant to voice my selfishness even to myself.
Yes.
I got the kids. I don't admit how afraid I was to press the divorce through on the off chance he might ask for some custody. The legal starting place is 50-50 split placement, and I'd have a hard road to get full time with the kids if he wanted his share. As heartbroken as I was when he left, I wasn't ready to contemplate missing every other week of my kids' lives on top of that pain.
You're still married,
Lena says, shaking her head in wonder.
I'm still married, I agree. To John, after 3 years apart.
I don't know what to tell you. It wasn't on my list of things to do.
That must be quite a list.
I try to explain another way. Getting unmarried was more of a picky detail in a chaotic time when those details had to be ignored so I could survive. It was like how I stopped scheduling haircuts for a year. And then, one day, things calmed down enough for me to notice that I needed a haircut, and I got one. No big deal.
So, now you notice you need a divorce,
Lena supplies,
and you go get one, and it's no big deal?
I blink. I haven't taken the analogy that far yet.
I guess so,
I say. But I don't guess that at all. Deep down, I have no intention of getting a divorce, I suddenly realize. I don't think now is the time to upset the apple cart. But I cannot tell Lena that. Honestly, I don't even want to think about it too much myself. John may be an asshole, I say needlessly, but he's a reasonable one. A divorce will simply be a matter of putting pen to paper, just like the haircut. No big deal. And then I pretend not to notice Lena's unquestionably skeptical expression. A week later, I'm in my bedroom packing. With a full week to go before I leave, it's almost laughable to be packing right now. But Corey is going to be crazy busy for the next 5 days before the end of school, and I will too, with the presentations and theses to read and just the nonstop rushing around of finals, grades, transcripts. And for once, Trinity isn't here. So, if I want my 15-year-old daughter's approval of every stitch of clothing I'm taking to New York, I have to get it now. And I do. She is the sartorial authority around here. The bedroom is spacious, and Corey's sort of draped on the upholstered bench at the foot of the bed, using her foot to poke the pile of my shoes near her, trying to unearth something that doesn't offend her. She has, at least once a day since she was 8, sprawled on this bench to tell me the secrets of her heart or the dramas of her friends. Not for the first time, I thank my lucky stars that, against all odds, we never had to move after John left. We had a great mortgage and loads of equity, and I suppose that's down to him. He insisted we put nearly a third down on this house to keep the monthly bill low and get it paid off faster. John was always really funny about debt. When he left, I refinanced from 15 years to 30 and didn't feel even remotely upset about it. And that dropped my monthly payment yet lower, making it cheaper to stay in our lovely big house full of memories than to rent anywhere nearby. And it is a lovely house.
The kids have their own rooms, plenty of closet space, which has gone from holding Lego sets and dress-up outfits to being packed with comic books, Joe, and mall sweaters, Corey. My daughter owns every mall sweater ever sold, some in multiple colors. If I take her to the mall, I can be sure she is coming back with a sweater. She brandishes them with double clearance tags and her frequent shopper discounts and tells me they were $6.88 or some other ridiculous price. But I cringe at the way she accumulates them, wears them once, and leaves them in a puddle on the floor for the rest of their days. Still, she always looks so nice, not just from youth, but also from some kind of eye for color and shape that skipped my generation. Anything I bring home from the store has to go by her before I cut the tags off, and many times she just looks at the clothes still in the bag and then raises her eyebrows skyward and says something like, "It's kind of exhausting to love someone who will never learn." Or, "Are you buying ugly clothes to make a point?" I have just such a shopping bag today. I went to Target with a $100 budget, basically an extravagant no-limits shopping spree in clearance rack dollars, and bought a stack of shirts and pants from the middle part of the store. Not the totally dowdy work collections I usually beeline for just before the maternity clothes and the dressing rooms, but not the junior's madness of the front third of the store either. In my bag, there are shirts in trend colors with vaguely low-cut necks, flowing blousy things with lace and embroidery, and even a just-above-the-knee skirt. Though, truth be told, I'm not entirely clear on how to wear skirts. Do they go with boots and tights in late May? I don't think I can do bare legs, can I? Is there some sort of publicly agreed-upon age limit for bare legs? I also brought home two pairs of dark jeans with two very different cuts, even knowing at least one of them is heinously wrong, and confident Corey will tell me which. That I have become pants blind, a common condition of aging where you can no longer say with any authority which of your pants are cut fashionably and which are mom jeans, is proof of my complete inability to shop without help. I take them all out while Corey watches me keenly and lay them out on the bed. "I was thinking," I tell her cautiously, "that these tops would match these pants, and these other ones would match the skirt, and then I won't need to take much luggage." "Shoes?" is all she says. "Oh yes, I am planning to wear them, absolutely." She sighs. "Look, in New York City, with a schedule of conferences, meetings, dinners, and dates, shoes should make up approximately half of your baggage weight." I blink at her. Is this some kind of scientific finding? Can you direct me to the abstract for my own review? And who said anything about dates? "Mom, stop being weird. You're going on dates." I start to tell her I'm not, but stop myself. A date might be kind of nice, actually, though I have no idea where any datees would come from. "Is any of this date appropriate?" She looks down at the clothes with scrutiny. "Well, maybe." She pulls the lowest cut top from the jeans side of the bed to the skirt side of the bed and drapes it with a long jangly necklace. Then she rolls up the skirt at the waist twice, making it significantly shorter, and puts it down with the top. Then she waves the, "wait a second," finger at me and disappears into her room. When she comes back seconds later, she's holding a pair of shoes I'm pretty sure I would not have approved had I known she had them. She puts them at the bottom of the outfit and says, "Date clothes, not a fancy date, but you're really not that fancy anyway." I look at the conservative size large mom clothes she's somehow turned into a hooker costume. "Corey, I'm not wearing that." "Well, it doesn't matter, does it? Because no one said anything about dates." She waggles her eyebrows at me. Just for a moment, I indulge myself in the idea of meeting someone in New York. "These are really pretty shoes," I say, picking up one sling back and marveling at the luck of having a stylish daughter who wears the same shoe size as me.
The toe is a black and gold geometric print. Just a bit 80s, but very me 30 years ago. The slingback strap loops all the way around the ankle, too, and is black leather. There is a tiny gold buckle. They are at once feminine and authoritative, understated and sexy. They are the most aspirational shoes I have ever seen. I want to be the kind of person who wears these shoes.
May I really borrow these? I ask. Of course, Mom. Not like I'm wearing them around Dad anyway.
If he's any kind of dad at all, he shouldn't allow it.
They're weirdly sexy for how low the heel is, right?
You're right. You're not allowed to wear these. Corey just laughs at me.
They were practically free anyway, she tells me, launching into the story of how she had a $15 off card and there was a 40% off sale at Macy's, and so on and so forth.
I tune out for a few moments, tilting my head and considering what it would feel like to wear a short skirt, slingbacks, and a slinky top around Manhattan in early spring. It would, I decide, feel incredible.
I'll buy them from you, I tell her right in the middle of her story, or buy you another pair that are less adult.
Corey beams.
Deal. Here.
She hands me her smartphone, where she's already pulled up a pair of ridiculous teal lace-up gladiators marked down below $20.
These are the replacement pair, she says to me.
I look at them for a moment. They are flats. Flats.
These are flats, I say aloud.
So then it's going to be Brian? Corey sighs deeply and lets her head tip to the side.
Brian, he's very short.
But cute, I say. Are you taller than him?
We're the same. Do you think he has a short man complex?
He's still growing, Corey. Besides, that's a thing people invented to justify judging men by their height.
But what about Napoleon?
She asks me. Power-hungry madmen come in all shapes and sizes, I tell her. Rather than worry about Brian's measurements, let's figure out if he's good enough for you. More sighing from my teenager.
I don't know how to tell, she says.
Slowly, I say, with your shirt on. Corey raises an eyebrow at me.
Okay, pants? I can do that, she says, and every single bone in my body sings with motherly joy. What am I looking for when I try to figure out if someone is good enough for me? She asks.
Well, what do you like most about the people you like? Include yourself, I instruct. She thinks for a moment.
I like people who are pretty kind deep down and also who tell the truth. I like people who show up when they say they're going to. Oh, and people who don't think they're better than everyone else.
I nod. That's a terrific list of things to watch for in Brian. I see all of those things in you, so you deserve all that and more. Corey chews her lip and works her jaw.
What?
I ask her.
Sometimes I act like I'm better than everyone else. You know, boys like it when you have confidence.
I smile. Maybe it's not an act. After all, I think you're the best girl I've ever known.
You're my mom. You have to think that.
I shake my head at her. Not true. But anyway, you are wonderful. But there's plenty of wonderful to go around. So keep that in mind if you find yourself walking around with your nose in the air.
I will if you will, she says.
Will do what? I ask her back.
Not be a snob. You're not too good for the entire male gender.
What? Who on earth said I was?
Well, why else wouldn't you go on a single date once in 3 years?
I blink at her blindly.
What can I say?
Because I was convinced John left me because I was unlovable? Because I am a 40-year-old mom-shaped librarian and not the porn kind with glasses and long hair in a bun, but the regular kind with clogs and pants blindness? Because every man I meet in my daily life is a parent of one of my students or a teacher of one of my kids?
Because somehow, after all this time, I am still married to my ex-husband?
Mom! Are you there?
Corey is waving her hands in front of my face.
Ground control to Major Mom.
Sorry, I spaced. I was thinking about... My eyes dart around the room and land on the clock. I was thinking about your brother. I'm supposed to bring oranges tonight. Do we have any oranges? I'd better get to Wegmans before pickup. Do you want anything? It's as easy as that. My daughter loves the Wegmans sushi counter.
Sushi!
She cries jubilantly, and all talk of dating is forgotten. Okay, sushi it is, I reply. I'll be back in an hour and a half. Will you bag up whichever clothes are awful and match outfits for the rest while I'm gone?
Duh, Mom, she replies. What do you want me to do with the other hour and 29 minutes?
I cock my head at her. How about you write a college admissions essay on the fine art of shoe packing for airline luggage weight restrictions?
I'll get right on it, she says sarcastically.
Or text with Brian, I add, as I'm halfway out the door so she can't feign disinterest.
Just a thought.
When it is finally time for me to go, I feel like I am the child and my kids are sending me off to summer camp. John, Lena, and my neighbor Jackie, who has offered to watch over my house and be a backup plan for the kids if they need it, are all there for the big goodbye, and I have the distinct sensation of being shoehorned out the door. Before I know it, I am being reassured that all is well, and I'll get lots of video calls, and Jackie will look after the yard and mail, and Lena will look after anything else. John looks so capable as we all say goodbye. He brought extensive pics of the condo he's rented, which looks immaculate and well-equipped, and he is even driving a rented Volvo. I can't help but think, this is okay. They've got this. Even as my mom brain screams, no, what are you doing? Do not leave your children. The sensation is so powerful that I actually make the cabbie turn around and drive me back by the house, pretending to have forgotten something. But when we reapproach, I see that the kids are sitting on either side of John on the front step, looking down at something. The book of hiking trails he brought over is open in his lap, overleaf unfolded wide to a map. His posture is relaxed and easy, leaned back, with each hand propping him up on either side beside the kids' backs. Corey's and Joe's heads are tilted in toward him, and they are laughing. What did Corey tell me this morning? Your work here is done, Mom. I laugh at the very thought. My work will never be done here. But for today, it's time for me to go. I tell the driver never mind, and we turn around, head back to the station. And I feel something happening to my shoulders that hasn't happened in 5 years, or maybe longer. They're relaxing. I feel the unfamiliar weight of my shoulders sliding down, and the pleasant sensation of tension unwinding from my neck and the base of my head. How long have I been holding my shoulders up by my ears, I wonder? And why was I doing that? I immediately think of the Christmas I caved and brought home a gaming system for my kids. The use policy on it is pretty stringent even now, and the first rule was I play every game they play. No Call of Duty 17 coming in under the radar at my house. Joe wanted to play a driving simulation game that required a little steering wheel attachment to the controller. He saved up and saved up and got the controller and the game, and then he came home with it knowing full well he would have to immediately hand it over to me. I took it, we opened it, and Joe gave me the gist of the game. Steer, don't crash. Try to collect floating coin things, use turbo points. It looked almost exactly like the driving games I played at my guys' friends' houses when I was in high school, except for better graphics and a very impressive soundtrack. I thought it would be no problem. But once I was playing, I was terrible. I couldn't steer and work the turbo at the same time, and I kept crashing into various obstacles like I was drunk. Finally, Joe grabbed me by the shoulders from the rightward lean I was in as I tried to steer the car out of a puddle and said, Mom, steer with the controller, not your body.
Now, as I sit on the hard wooden bench waiting for the New York Express train, I realize I have been driving my life with my body, trying somehow to carry my worries and sorrows and insecurities on my shoulders, as though I could wad up all the hurt and fear I've felt since John moved out, stuff it in a backpack, and hike through life with it. Every time I have fretted over Joe's social life, or lain awake listening like a hawk for Corey to make curfew, or looked at my income and our bills and tried to figure out who won't get paid, I have put that in the backpack and carried it around on my shoulders. They ache, and I haven't even noticed until right this minute. Consciously, I take a huge breath. I bring my mind to those poor muscles and sinews and vessels and think, melt. I think of my kids safe with their father, overseen by Jackie, who is overseen by Lena, and think again, melt. I think of my waiting guest room in Talia's swank apartment and the classes I'll get to take at Columbia and the lunches at bistros with big, gorgeous, fresh salads and crisp white wines I'll linger over, and I just feel it happen for the first time in as long as I can remember. I melt, and it feels so good. And then my train comes, and the entire adventure begins. Chapter 4. Dear Mom, you're in New York, having a life. Mom, I am so freaking proud of you. You are like a marvel and an inspiration to us all. I am totally being sarcastic in case that's not clear. But really, I am proud that you finally took a vacation, even if it's not really a vacation, and you're actually doing library stuff nonstop, and the only way we got you to do it was to sacrifice our own week. Which, let's be clear, Dad is not our first choice right now. But here we are, and Dad is like Mr. Happy Cheerleader, and he is going to give us anything we ask for out of guilt, and I will have failed myself and my country if I don't get out of this with a new car. At least. Joe is angling for space camp. Did you know that? I am so proud of him. I didn't know he had it in him. And all you get is a stupid week in New York, probably staying at, like, the Super 8 in Yonkers and reading books in bed all night. You should have brought me with you. I'd show you how this whole vacation thing is done. We'd be at the spa, not the $12 nail salon, but the spa that, like, rock stars go to. We'd get you a makeover and then go out to Balthazar and then go see Hamilton. We would eat that pizza you fold in half, and we'd go to the art museums, and you'd let me drink white wine. Here's what I'm doing instead. The same thing I'd be doing pretty much if you were here. Someone gave Dad a copy of Coach's Summer Rules, so I'm on curfew, and he is serving salad with every meal. Also, when we first walked into his apartment, there was Diet Coke freaking everywhere, and I was so pumped. Then, while I was literally in the bathroom doing my hair, the Diet Coke just vanished. Did you, like, text Dad and tell him no Diet Coke? How can you hate Diet Coke, Mom? Diet Coke is the foundation of America. Why do you hate this country so much? Dad said I can have Diet Coke once a day before noon, but only after practice, and he said I have to have a shot of wheatgrass juice to go with it. And I said, where is this wheatgrass juice coming from? The Bucks County Municipal Pool concession stand? Is it right next to the Slurpee machine? And do you know what he said back? He said, your team doesn't have a juicer? No kidding, Mom. I was going to say, no shit, but I'm moving into my summer vocab for lifeguarding, so no kidding. I was like, to Dad, hey, dum-dum, on what planet does a community day school have a juicing machine for team sports? And he got out this link to Harvard Business Review, which is something he reads, like, on the regular, and showed me a story about a juice bar company that revolutionized the efficacy of NFL double day practices. And then he went on this Amazon app and, no shit, he bought a wheatgrass juicer for the team. He is from another planet, Mom. Planet rich guy. But look, it's not all bad because now my team gets a juicer and I get a subscription to Harvard Business Review. And I am pretty sure I used the words revolutionized the efficacy appropriately in that sentence up there. So it's win, win, win. Dad buys our love. I get a vocabulary. Team gets a juicer. Except I guess you are the loser. I have to remind you of that, according to every teen movie I have ever watched. But if it makes you feel any better, it's almost like you're here every time you text me and tell me to get reading on my next book. And not in a good way. Untwist your thong. I will get on with it. I'm just letting the love story of the senator's wife and her rich married boyfriend wash over me. Next, according to you, I'm supposed to read The Book Thief. I read the first chapter, and let me tell you, it sounds grim. Pro tip, Mom, it's not summer reading if the narrator is actual death incarnate. Like, if you open any magazine ever and look at their summer beach reads roundup and see a book starring death, just let me know. Until that day, I am reading Twilight again, because if I am going to be goth, then it should be sexy goth at least. What? At least I'm reading. Love, your vitamin-rich daughter, Corey. New York is exactly as I left it, and entirely different. Grand Central is the same grimy, glossy crossbreed that it should be. The Oyster Place is going nowhere. The hubbub is as loud. The goings-on are as ongoing. But the clothes are different. The stores are unfamiliar. The sense of having been here before and yet being utterly lost is pervasive. I march through the echoey corridors and try not to look confused, searching for the right subway stairs. Then I get my carry-on suitcase stuck in the turnstiles and give up on coolness. Hello, New York. Get ready to chew up and spit out another willing bumpkin. Last week, when I gave her the high sign about my arrival, Talia told me her apartment is a zillion miles from Columbia and tried to talk me into skipping the conference and just using my time to lie about the apartment looking wan and drinking wine. I couldn't look wan if I were on a hunger strike, so I stuck to my plan, believing there are worse things than an hour on the train each way. I can read. It will be peaceful. But it's rush hour, and I wedge myself on the local because the first two express trains are too full to fit my suitcase, much less my body, and there is nothing peaceful about what happens next. We are packed in so tightly that I do not need to hold a handrail to stand upright, but the helpful spinner wheels on my suitcase that are so nice when rushing through an airport, something I never do, by the way, become deadly on the train. At every stop, and there are about 400 stops, the bag demonstrates the thing in motion tends to remain in motion principle and rolls into the person next to me, banging them against the shins. I attempt to hold the suitcase back, but am being pressed forward by the post-workout gym rat behind me, who is carrying a duffel on his shoulder and letting it hit me in the kidneys every time he shifts an inch. And so we go. My suitcase bruises shins, the duffel of rocks bruises me, and just out of reach, eight middle-aged men in suits sit comfortably on the benches that line the car, legs spread open like they are on their own personal Barca loungers, papers folded into precise fourths, phones clenched in right hands for dear life. It's a funny little thing, the miracle of getting a subway seat, and I am starting to feel bitter that I do not have one. When a woman with a pregnant belly the size of a small neutron star gets on the train, and the humanity parts. She is sweaty and wide and no kind of fertility goddess. But first one, now two, then three men leap to their feet in something resembling a panic. "Ma'am," each shouts, "do you want to sit down?" She does, and one of the men who wasn't lucky enough to actually give up his seat to her puts his phone away and carries her enormous Bed Bath & Beyond bag on his lap for the rest of the ride. Oh, how it warms my heart, this whole little play that runs 1,000 times a day. New York, the city that never sits. When we get to Brooklyn Heights, I pop out of the train like a champagne cork the moment the doors open. I walk the wrong direction on several slanted crisscrossing streets, falter a bit, and then become the woman getting turn-by-turn directions from her phone while walking. Luckily, it is New York, and nothing here is noteworthy. Certainly not me. Finally, I find Talia's building. It is not what I expected. Based on Facebook updates, her monthly editor's letter, and my memories, Talia is very glitzy. This building is not glitzy. It's red brick, no edifice, very institutional. It's not a divided brownstone with cute wrought iron gates or a shiny glass tower with a bank of elevators zooming to the stratosphere. It looks to be about 10 stories high and utilitarian in design, and the lobby is not exactly inviting me in. Even so, I grab the handle and pull. The door is locked. I tilt my head. Pull again. Nope, this door is definitely locked. I put my hands around my face and try to see inside. Another bank of doors, then a small lobby with a desk. A concierge desk, one would think. A desk of a person who would, ostensibly, see me struggling with luggage and a locked door and get over here and let me in. There is no one at the desk. There is no one in the lobby, period. There is no indication whatsoever that anyone has ever been in the lobby or that this apartment building is, in fact, an apartment building and not an abandoned shirt factory. Are there even mailboxes? I don't see any in the vestibule. What kind of no-doorman building doesn't have mailboxes in the vestibule? Also, why did I assume this was a doorman building? Why did I figure Talia had amazing digs? Did she even answer me those weeks ago when I asked her if she had room for me? I looked back at our texts. She did not answer. But it seemed like a yes to me at the time. What if she lives in a studio and expects me to crash out on the couch? Well, then I guess I will crash on the couch, I realize with some kind of gloomy disappointment. I was imagining at least a bed to myself. Ah, well, I'm a grown woman, and a week on a couch 4 feet from the kitchen is kind of a bummer at this stage in my life, but a far smaller bummer than a $1,000 hotel bill. And besides, Talia is so fun. Wherever she lives, it will be fun. Think of the zillions of trendy, twee spots I passed on the way to her apartment, after all. An artisan candy bar shop that sells homemade Snickers and creme de menthe. A patisserie prominently displaying a wedding cake made entirely of lemony yellow macarons. A bar designed to look like an ancient dive with a high shine on it that gives its youth away. A chalkboard sign outside, intricately hand-lettered with vintage flair, reads, "Far or near, we drink Blatt's beer." And next to it, the ubiquitous cotton sportswear store boasting thong leotards and inexpensive American-made t-shirts cut for the bodies of 5'8" toddlers. I do not need a bed proper to enjoy a week in Brooklyn among the young and beautiful. We are going to have an amazing time. I text Talia. How do I get into your apartment? There is no immediate reply. Oh well, I guess I will go have a cup of sustainably sourced, frog-safe, hand-roasted, burr-ground pour-over coffee while I wait for further instructions. It's a good thing I only packed one very small suitcase. 2 cups of $7.50 coffee later, I have not heard from Talia. I also haven't heard from the many other people I texted to pass the time. Nothing from the kids, which makes sense because they should be at Corey's diving meet right now. A thumbs up and the swimmer emoji from John, who is doing same. Nothing from Lena, who has plenty of good reasons not to be sitting by the phone waiting to entertain her lonely, temporarily homeless friend. My neighbor Jackie writes back when I say, "How is it going there?" But all she says is, "All's fine. Hope you're having fun." So I do not take that as an invitation to chat. I have my e-reader, and I've started and stopped a few different YA titles, always looking for those unputdownable reads that I think will appeal to my trickier readers. And I've checked the address Talia sent me a few hundred times, and the weather, and the conference information page, and anything else I could think of to pass the time. Now it's getting on in the day, and there's supposed to be a cocktail meet and greet up at the conference in 2 hours. Knowing it could take a full hour just to get there, I'm starting to feel nervous. I text Talia again, sending her back the address she sent me and writing, "Do I have the right address? I'm sorry, I didn't think to figure out the key situation. I guess I assumed you had a doorman." Then I wait 5 minutes and call her. No answer. I leave the calmest possible voicemail and then say out loud, "Okay, this is bad." And this being New York, no one bats an eye. I collect my things and go back to the building. There is still no doorman, no mailboxes, no buzzers, no way in. I wait 10 minutes. No one so much as walks down this side of the street, much less opens the door. I look harder for a buzzer, planning to start disturbing the neighbors. There is no buzzer. In what universe is there an apartment building with no doorman, but also no buzzer? This cannot be the right place. I triple-check the numbers on the door against the numbers Talia sent me. This is the correct address. Could a person get her own address wrong? Could she have given me the wrong street name? Who would do that, though? For the 10th time now, I scroll back to our minimal planning. She said to text before I came. I texted. She wrote back telling me to go straight to the apartment and that she'd tell the people downstairs to watch for me. I assumed that meant there would be a doorman. What other people downstairs could there be? Maybe a landlord or super? But there's no basement apartment where such a person would be accessible, and no way to the back of the building that I can see either. Just a locked side door with no window that I presume is for trash removal. Totally stumped, I step to the other side of the street and look up at the building. This is a big, amazing city. People work all kinds of hours. Someone must be home right now. But the windows are all dark, reflecting the city back to me, and on this fine sunny day, there is no way of knowing who is home, or if anyone lives here at all, or what the hell is going on. I call Talia again. This voicemail is a little more panicky. When I hang up, I realize it is time for me to give up on this building and move on to Plan B. What on earth is my plan B? There was one moment after John left, not a long one, but a real one, when I thought I was going to die. It was money that did it. Money, a broken tooth, and bedwetting. Joe was 8 years old. He was a late bloomer in everything, so different from Corey, who, after spending a day at her grandmother's farm and playing with older kids from a neighboring farm with no indoor plumbing, asked them why they went into the tiny house with a moon shape cut into the door. They explained, quite clearly, I suppose, that tinkling in your diaper was for babies. And from that day on, she peed in a little potty I had to put outside and rig a tarp around. I'm not sure what we would have done if it had been winter. A few weeks of that, and she came in, climbed up on the real toilet, pooped, and demanded a cookie, and that was toilet training. Joe, not so much. For Joe, I tried all culturally approved methods, including letting him toddle around the house naked from the waist down, which resulted in pee in all rooms of the house except for the bathroom. I had some decent success with bribing him with toy trains, but at night he used a pull-up diaper for a year longer than many moms might have tolerated. My mom, especially, was horrified by this, and I remember crying from the disapproval after every visit. Even after all that tolerance, though, when he was finally in big boy underpants and completely housebroken by day, if he got sick, had a nightmare, or drank too much before bed, he'd wake up wet until he was almost 5. Then, 3 years later, his dad disappeared, and Joe took it out on his mattress pad. I was already tired. Corey was so mad all the time. She called me names, said I was ugly, and that was why her dad left. She said she was ugly, and that was why her dad left, and she hoped he would die. After any little normal frustration of life, like a lost shoe or a hard test, she'd rail and rail, and then after 20 minutes, she'd let me put my arms around her, and she'd cry and cry. Joe had started sneaking into my bed, coming in silently around 4 a.m., tossing and turning and kicking me after he was out cold again,
leaving me to choose between his twin bunk or the couch until the sun came up. We were out of money, but I refused to consider selling the house and was paying old bills out of the modest salary I got from Country Day and then putting new bills on one of the three low-rate introductory cards I'd taken out the minute I'd realized I could. I hadn't figured out how to be a working single mother yet. I was disorganized and grieving and wouldn't surrender to the situation, too wedded to the idea that this all was temporary, that it was only a matter of time before John appeared back in our lives. So we were surviving, but only just. Then I got a cold. It was just a run-of-the-mill cold, but it was enough to destroy our precious balance. I couldn't get myself to cook after a long day, so we ordered pizza, so we ran up more bills, so we maxed out a card. I was stoned on Dayquil all day and got reprimanded at work, and Corey caught me crying in the car. Then I caught her shoplifting a lipstick. Then Joe started wetting his bed. That added a half hour of awake time to my night, changing sheets and getting him back to bed, and hours of worry to my day. Then, while he and I were visiting the child psychologist I couldn't afford to deal with the bed wetting, Corey fell off some friend's longboard and broke one of her front teeth in half. The goddamned moron mother of the friend called 911, of all things, instead of just calling me. It was a chipped tooth in a cul-de-sac 10 minutes from the dentist's office, but now I was paying for an ambulance. Thankfully, I was able to meet them at the ER before she was fully checked in. I turned her around, looked her over for other damage, took a pamphlet on concussion, and marched her right out of there before anyone took my credit card. The tooth was repaired, the child psychologist was reassuring, and the ER bills had been narrowly averted. The crisis was over. And yet, around 2 a.m. that night, I had a panic attack that felt like nothing I had ever experienced before. In that moment, I knew I would die, knew with certainty. Knew if I took one more step ahead in this hard life I had tumbled into, I would collapse. I had to stop everything. I sat up in my bed, wheezing, and the room began to go black. I was in a tunnel of light. The air stopped coming in. I was breathing, but air wasn't reaching my lungs. I tried sniffing in through my nose and felt light. I thought, I am dying. But I didn't feel afraid of that. It was another day like this one that scared me so. Another day like this was just not something I could survive. In the minute, the hour, however long this attack lasted, I made all the plans I could possibly make to escape my situation. My house would sell for enough. My mother would come and watch over the kids until John came back. Maybe I would be brave enough to kill myself for the life insurance. Ugh. That awful panic that made that seem like the best plan. Or maybe I would just run away, as far as I could get, and be alone for the rest of my days and never feel true joy again. In that moment, those were my only two choices. I believed that. I thank God I was so sleep-deprived that night, because the only thing that won out over that deathly panic in the end was exhaustion, as well as confusion over which pills to take and whether I had enough to do the job. The next morning, early, I called Lena. I didn't tell her everything, but then I didn't have to. I said only, "It's too much. I can't." She didn't say, "You can." Better still, she didn't say, "But you have to." She said, "I'll be there in 10 minutes. She was. She put me to bed with half a Benadryl and told me to sleep as much as I possibly could. I was barking orders about the kids, and then she pulled up the covers and said firmly, "Enough." I was so tired, I fell asleep the moment she turned out the light. And so, when the choices were sleep or die, I slept. I woke up 2 days later. The kids were told I had gotten really tired. They were told they had a new set of chores befitting their new status as equal members of a three-person household, rather than two kids and two adults. Using one of those teacher-sized noteboards, Lena made a list of all the work needing done in a regular household and then asked Joe and Corey to put a tick next to everything they could possibly do. The first two were earn money and drive.
The kids quickly figured out that since they couldn't do those two highly vital tasks, they had better take on a lot of other things. They needed to be asked, and they always waited until 2 hours before allowance time, but they did their fair share from then on out. Lena used a lying around pay stub to sign me up for supplemental nutrition assistance, food stamps, and gave me a stern lecture about pride. The state started sending me almost $350 to pay for groceries each month. I caught up on my bills, rented out my garage to someone who wanted winter storage for his boat, canceled our streaming services, sold my stuff, got my shit together, threw a fit until our insurer paid for Joe's therapy, and solved each problem in its turn until the crisis was over. And when it was, I told myself I'd never be as dependent on any one person again as I had been on John. And I never will be. So, I'd better think of somewhere to sleep in New York City. Plan B, it turns out, is to forget how to get back to the subway. Once again, I am juggling luggage and listening to turn-by-turn directions just to retrace my steps for 6 blocks. When I arrive at the station and am able to at last put away my phone and get myself together, I find myself sort of disappointed in this kinder, gentler New York where no one robbed the slow-moving target I made of myself. Then I wait for the train. 10, then 15, then 20 minutes before another packed Manhattan-bound train pulls up to the platform. Just as it does, I realize that I am on the wrong platform. Worse, the wrong station to get up to Columbia. And when I finally do straggle into the conference, I will be the dope wheeling my suitcase and wearing stretch pants. I cannot think of how I could possibly get into my cocktail attire between here and there. Even buying a cup of coffee in a Starbucks won't get me the kind of bathroom where I could safely, say, take off my shoes without acquiring several diseases and maybe some cockroaches, too. I could look up the location of Talia's offices and try her there, but there's no indication that she'd be there. Or is even still alive. And since the magazine she works for is part of an international multimedia conglomerate in Midtown Manhattan, there's no chance of me getting past the front lobby alone. But then I think of the old St. Regis maneuvers Talia and I used to pull. Do I still have what it takes to pull a fast one on a hotel clerk? I guess there's just one way to find out. The only time John and I came to New York together, we stayed the night at a lovely 3-star boutique hotel on the Upper West Side, right on the way to Columbia. It had a gorgeous French bistro with the prettiest, cleanest, sunniest dining room I had ever eaten in, with glass doors in lieu of walls that folded open in the warm afternoons so that tables spilled out onto the sidewalks and the glasses of white wine glinted in the sun. The rooms were a small fortune per night. Maybe double the nicest hotel I'd stayed in previously, and there's no way I can swing that cost as a single mother. But I don't need to actually buy a room to attempt a trick I learned from Talia in college. I spent the whole train ride to the Upper West Side working up the guts to try it and simultaneously trying to make myself look like the sort of person who would succeed. After I switch trains twice, I get a seat and dig around in my luggage for lipstick, mascara, and a very expensive gold necklace John bought me when I had Corey. I mess around with my outfit a bit, and finally, feeling wildly self-conscious, change into Corey's black slingbacks, stuffing my Dansko clogs into my bag and jamming it shut. Finally, I switch my black nylon travel bag out for my ace in the hole, a real, honest-to-God saline handbag Lena gave me to use for this trip. It's beautiful. Rich black leather, lambskin lining, gold chain, and iconic sprawling folded sides with the stamped logo front and center for good measure. If I succeed, it will be because of this bag. At 79th Street, I come up to the street. It is still bright and sunny, though a little less light reaches through all the tall buildings and dense streets than it did in Brooklyn Heights. I put on my Target sunglasses, hope they don't look quite as Targety as they probably do, and feel around the block for the hotel, hoping it is right where I left it all those years ago. There it is. The bistro is still there too, with no sign of change.
The doors are open, and a few early diners are at the sidewalk tables, enjoying the early evening glow. There's a pleasant buzz about the place. Lots of people are going in and out of the hotel doors. That's exactly as I want it. So, here we go. I take in a deep breath and try to channel Jamie Lee Curtis in A Fish Called Wanda, the platonic ideal of a con woman. I push open the door and quickly size things up. Okay, good. One person at the desk, a line to check in. This is going to be easier than I thought. I get in the line as if to wait, but I have no intention of reaching the front of the line. I check my watch, which I'm actually not wearing. I sigh loudly and look around. I spot a bellman who is already looking at me. I take my opening.
Disculpe, I say. Necesito un favor.
He replies in a quick tongue I can barely follow. Apparently, I fooled him into treating me like a fluent speaker. That'll teach me. I smile meekly. I'm waiting to check in, but the line is long and I'm supposed to meet my husband for drinks in 5 minutes. Can I just stow my luggage with you and check in later?
Of course, ma'am, he replies in English. What is your last name?
Knowing there's a tiny chance he might try to connect it to a room number, I say, actually, if there's a bathroom I might use first, I'll freshen up quickly and then give you my bag. Could you point the way? The helpful fellow does just that. I rush to the ladies, which of course is beautiful and clean and has all kinds of lovely toiletries. There, I turn myself into the most presentable version of me I can be without a shower and dash out. I am wearing a skirt now and a pretty cap-sleeved rayon blouse that wouldn't wrinkle in an avalanche and a little lightweight wool blazer. I feel like a person. A librarian person, but still, a person. I am so, so glad I shaved my legs this morning. 5 minutes later, I come back out, find the helpful fellow, give him my bag, and act very rushed. It's easy, because I am in fact very rushed at this point. I tip him $10, and when he asks again for my name, I just holler, "Just write Sandra on it. Gracias!" and rush out the door before he can push the issue. I say Sandra because Sandra is the most elegant name in the world, and anyone named Sandra should be staying in a beautiful hotel like this whenever she travels anywhere. And then I burst out into the sunshine again and mentally give myself a high five and say to the city, "See, New York? I can still handle you. I can still handle you just fine." Chapter 5. Dear Mom, I have a question for you when you do read this. Were you and Dad ever really happy? I look back and I don't remember you guys being especially happy or sad. Now Dad seems incredibly happy, but I'm not sure if it's forced happiness to make us think we're all having tons of fun together, or if he's just a happy person or what. And I'm wondering, was he like that when we were all together? Did you guys, like, dance around the kitchen while you were cooking together or hold hands at the park while Joe and I played or stuff like that? Sorry, I know those are both scenes from movies, but I don't have a ton of real-life married love experience to go on. Trinity's mom is getting another divorce. Did I tell you that? Whenever I think my dad is an asshole, I just have to look over at her house and think, could be worse. Sorry, Trinity, but hashtag truth. So, I guess I'm asking, did Dad make you happy? Does being in love make you happy? Were you two ever in love?